Our next case is 10-2158, State of Ohio versus Jack Carlisle. Ms. Cunliffe?
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Erica Cunliffe. I'm here on behalf of Jack Carlisle. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We are asking this court to articulate a bright line rule, one which has already been embraced by every single district court of appeals in this state, which permits the trial court to modify a prison sentence either up or down prior to its execution. Such a rule is consistent with this court's precedent, the General Assembly's dictates, and the Constitution. The rule stems from a practice that is so well accepted in this state that it will not require additional litigation to seek further clarification, while the various constructions that have been offered by the state, its amici, and the 8th District will only promote confusion and additional litigation while everyone attempts to clarify what it is those various proposals mean. According
and
to
counsel,
the state.
In the instances where you said it's been the universally applied in all of our appellate districts, it's a modification of the sentence by the trial court post exhaustion of appeals.
There are several cases that I've cited that address that specifically.
But not universally. That hasn't been the case universally. Is that true?
That probably. I mean, there were so many cases that have adopted the idea that the sentences can be modified prior to the execution.
Prior to the execution, and I think don't think that's being challenged here. It's the challenge that it's post-exhaustion of the appellate process that is the distinguishing mark here. And you're telling me that every time that that has been addressed on the appellate level or the trial court level, the modification has been allowed or unchallenged?
There have been challenges, but they have been allowed. And obviously the sticking point here is the mandate rule, what it says and how it's construed.
The sticking point is what?
The mandate rule, RC 294505. I mean, that's what the 8th District concluded, that rule itself basically created a situation where once the defendant noted an appeal, he lost jurisdiction except in further aid of the appeal. The court lost jurisdiction except in further aid of the appeal. And then once the case is resolved through the appeals and affirmed, then the court held that the mandate rule forbid any further modification. There really is, other than the mandate rule itself, which could be construed that way, but has not been, except by the 8th District. There is little support for that, if at all, in any of the other districts. Cossack by the 7th District, Evans by the 4th District, both cases addressed post-appeal modifications prior to execution. And really, the reasons for it, and they're noted in both decisions, are, you know, just from time to time, judges' factual circumstances occur that require judges to address additional factors that are relevant to the sentence prior to its execution.
And do those customarily reduce the term of incarceration?
Not at all. No, my circumstances are pretty rare. The ones that this case presents.
Seems to me that the state is contesting the fact that the defendant was sentenced to a term, I think, of 3 years incarceration.
That's
and now
correct.
He faces no incarceration or minimal incarceration for time served. Right?
270 days plus now he has 5 years of probation. And it's a fairly restrictive term of probation.
But that isn't the holding of the other appellate districts, that trial judges, while the case is pending on appeal.
Sentences were reduced.
Pardon me, please.
Sentences were reduced. I think in both cases the sentences were reduced.
But pending appeal, the trial courts customarily eliminate the period of incarceration?
No, I'm not saying it's customary. I'm saying that in both the cases, at least Evans and Cossack, those are the two that I can grab my mind around right at the moment. Those were both post-appeal, post-exhaustion of appeal sentences, where the actual appeal addressed the crime, not the sentence, and affirmed. And when the case went back to the trial court revisited based on new issues that were raised and modified the sentence, similarly to what's present here.
Do you agree that any issues that the Court of Appeals considered cannot be modified, or do you maintain that because the sentence has not been yet executed, because he's not served the prison time yet, if he's been out on bond, for example, on appeal, that you can still even modify matters that were appealed and resolved?
No, Justice Stratton. I think that in that case, other factors, other doctrines would come into play, like res judicata and law of the case. If Mr. Carlisle had challenged the sentence, the three-year sentence imposed, and the court had examined the sentence and scrutinized the sentence, and I think he would have a much more difficult time. And that was in the Cossack case.
Difficult time or not, it's not an avenue even available.
Well, you know, if Mr. Carlisle had a stroke and he were absolutely incapacitated in a hospital, it might create extraordinary circumstances, which the mandate rule does recognize, there have been exceptions to the mandate rule. I think everybody can agree that the mandate rule is not absolute, and sometimes intervening case law, and I would argue intervening circumstances, might call for a modification that deviated in some way from the mandate. But the critical issue here is that this court has not construed the mandate rule in such a way that it is an automatic bar to revisiting a sentence or revisiting aspects of the case that were not within the compass of the decision.
What about the decision that this court rendered in State Ex Rel Special Prosecutors in 1978? Are you familiar with the case?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, it seems to me there it indicated, or this court explained, the judgment of the reviewing court is controlling on the lower court as to all matters within the compass of the judgment. And stress that absent remand, the trial court does not gain jurisdiction subject to subsequent to a court of appeals decision.
Well,
has that been modified to your knowledge by other cases or statutes?
Not exactly, but what I think I'm saying is that the modification was outside of the compass, and I'm saying that special prosecutors is distinguishable from the instant case.
How did the trial court regain jurisdiction subsequent to the determination of the Court of Appeals?
The Court of Appeals, and then this court denied jurisdiction, and the case was remanded back to the trial court for execution of sentence.
But your view is then that the court can and modify as opposed to execute the sentence?
As according to this court's decisions, and I'm talking about Cordray versus Marshall and Nolan versus Nolan, the as long as the revisiting is not a marked deviation from the mandate itself, which this is not, that other issues outside of the compass of the decision can be visited. And so you mentioned special prosecutors, and special prosecutors, the defendant, he had pled guilty and then challenged the guilty plea in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals affirmed affirmed the conviction. And then later, the defendant went back on a motion to vacate the guilty plea based on the same issues, and this court rightly said that the court had no jurisdiction to visit that issue again because it had already been looked at and scrutinized.
Well, in Nolan, we held that absent extraordinary circumstances, an inferior court has no discretion to disregard a mandate of a superior court. Wasn't that the holding in Nolan?
But Nolan also specified that the mandate is that issues that are not markedly deviating from the mandate itself, and the words are markedly deviating.
The court can't vary the mandate of the appellate court.
No.
You're not arguing that.
Of course not.
So you're saying that if the subject isn't addressed by the appellate court, but the decision is affirmed, then the trial court somehow regains jurisdiction to resentence the defendant?
To resentence the defendant based on if issues require the modification. That's correct. That is our position.
Counsel, let's talk. Oh, I'm sorry.
Just one follow-up then to that. It occurs to me that there's a proper motion to file for early release from a sentence. What's the purpose of that statute if a trial court somehow just has inherent jurisdiction to modify the sentence.
You know, maybe the history can be a little more laid out, I guess. I mean, the General Assembly does not say that modifications are not proper. And they provide for judicial release.
There's a specific statute that talks about early release from a penitentiary.
Judicial release. There's a specific statute that was created in 1996. That's correct. But the fact that the General Assembly created that statute, which is basically a recodification of another statute, and says nothing about the ability to modify pre-execution, shouldn't override the trial judge's ability to exercise jurisdiction over the case that he has in front of him, which the Constitution permits.
Thank you. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Counsel, that leads into my question. In fact, may have touched upon quite a bit of it. The circumstances in this case involve some medical conditions that the judge took into consideration in the resentencing. Let's assume for a moment that we find that the judge did not have authority to modify the sentence before execution. What is available then to the defendant in this case to essentially accomplish the same purpose after beginning to serve the sentence? I guess we have judicial release that has some conditions in it. I'm not quite sure how long those would be, but what are the mechanisms then, assuming there is no ability to modify?
There are mechanisms. What has troubled me about availing myself of my client of those mechanisms, it would require him to go into the system and be processed through the system. He is hospitalized at this moment with an infection from the dialysis. Complications due to the dialysis have caused an infection in his abdomen. And so he would, if he goes into the system, he still has to be processed. He won't have access immediately to dialysis. And his doctor has been concerned about continuity of care. I believe that there's some letter and discussion in the record concerning the doctor's concerns. And then there's a certain amount of time that he would have to spend, and we could either prevail upon the trial court or prevail upon the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction for his release. I'm not sure then at that point what happens to his insurance coverage. So
he's currently under private insurance for this care.
He has a combination of Medicare and private insurance.
And if he is subjected to the institution, even if he was furloughed on a medical furlough, you're saying he would lose that?
I'm just concerned about that. I don't have enough expertise.
You don't know?
But I am concerned about it.
Okay. Is that something we should be concerned about, that the fact that right now there's a alternative method of dealing with this very expensive medical treatment, and the Department of Corrections and Rehab, or Rehab and Corrections, won't have to pay for that?
Well, they still have to pay for it for a certain amount of time, because he'll still end up in there for a certain amount of time, unless the law is changed in ways that I'm not aware of, and that certainly could be possible. I mean, that he has to go into the system. I'm running out of time. I would like to reserve the balance for rebuttal, please.
Do you want to answer the question?
Yes,
first?
I just don't want to run out of time. Your Honor, I think that first of all, the state will still have to pay. They'll still have to pay a certain amount, and it's a big amount. And then we can effectuate his release. Again, at that point, I'm not sure about his insurance coverage. The fact of the matter is, the judge had jurisdiction to do this because the case was still within the auspice of the trial court. And that's what we'd ask this court to hold. Thank you.
Mr. Regas.
May it please the court, Alan Regas. From the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, arguing on behalf of the state of Ohio. This case is simply about finality in a criminal sentence. In 2007, Jack Carlisle was sentenced to a term of imprisonment of 3 years, the minimum sentence for his crimes of kidnapping with a sexual motivation, 6-year-old niece, and committing a gross sexual imposition. He got the minimum sentence in 2007. It was affirmed on appeal in 2008. When it went back to the trial court in 2009, the trial court, without any authority statutory or legal authority changed the mandate, did not listen to the Court of Appeals, and altered a final criminal judgment.
Counsel, was the length or circumstances of the sentence appealed to the 8th District?
It was not raised as an assignment of error in the first appeal.
So the 8th District never considered the propriety of the 3-year sentence on appeal?
In the original direct appeal in 2008, no, it didn't.
Okay.
However, I would point out that all of the circumstances raised in 2010, 3 years later, to the court to change that sentence were known. Mr. Carlisle had been in the county jail for 200 and some days, then required dialysis. He was given a bond and released pending the outcome of the trial. He was then given an appellate bond for his direct appeal. That was continued when he attempted to appeal to this court, which declined jurisdiction over his direct appeal. So the trial court and Mr. Carlisle had already made a record of his medical condition and the potential costs associated with dialysis and his other condition.
That he's already, that he was sick then and he's sick now? And
why does it matter? Your Honor, there's two reasons. Number one, I think this case comes simply down to the mandate rule, but
if the propriety of the sentence was not considered by the 8th District in the first direct appeal, then there's no mandate from the court sanctioning what the lower court did with regards to the appeal.
Well, I think that
the sentence.
I look at it in a different way. And I think when the court said conviction affirmed, sentence to be executed, simply because he did not contest his appeal at that time. That's when we have.
He didn't contest his sentence.
His sentence, I'm sorry. He didn't contest the sentence at that time. He's precluded from doing that. We
but
will never have.
He's not contesting the sentence. He goes back to the trial court and says, I'd like to be relieved of the three. I'd like a resentencing. Resentencing is what he asked for, correct?
That is, he asked for modification of his sentence.
All right, and then the trial court modifies it based on the evidence that's presented, the medical evidence, et cetera.
And in this case, if we allow the courts to do that, no criminal sentence is ever final.
Well,
the court
that's not true. If it's executed, it's final. This is pre-execution, pre-entry into the Department of Rehab and Corrections custody.
Exactly. And I don't think that that rule, that practice, has any basis in authority since the criminal code was changed.
Counsel,
since
we
changed the sentencing.
What's the harm? You talk about the mandate rule, and the chief has already explored with you that you can certainly read it the way the trial court did, and that is the sentence that trial court handed out was not the subject of discussion in the 8th District. And so a modification of the sentence does not violate anything that the 8th District was talking about in the initial direct appeal. It doesn't seem to me that it would be likely that trial judges who have criminal defendants appeal how the trial judge handled their trial and or sentencing if they pled, goes to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals said trial court got it just right, that there would be a big marketplace for lawyers to come in and say, well, let's take another look at the sentence. It would seem to me trial judges are very busy and they're not going to countenance that except under very unusual circumstances like you have here. And why wouldn't we want the trial judges to have some leeway to do what this trial judge did in this very unusual circumstance?
Number one, I don't know if this is very unusual.
Well, a criminal defendant who has dialysis would be fairly unusual, wouldn't it?
I don't know the statistics, but let's not say it's dialysis, someone with a medical condition. How many inmates go into the prison system with hepatitis C, which is a very costly disease which requires treatment? That's not unusual to sentence someone to prison that requires expensive medical treatments. However, if we allow trial courts to ignore mandates, if we allow defendants to not raise their sentence to the Court of Appeals because they don't think they have a favorable forum, but yet come back after appeal, we now give them the ability to piecemeal litigation, to choose and find a favorable forum. Not all judges, trial courts, would look at this, no, Your Honor. No, most would just simply deny it and look at the execution. But for those trial judges that would look at this, this is allowing piecemeal litigation. There's no finality in this sentence. Then in 2007, we assumed
there doesn't seem to be much finality about anything in our criminal justice system. I mean, there are all sorts of avenues for those who can afford a lawyer or get the interest of the public defender to continue to pursue matters. There are.
In this case,
there's not much that's really final, is there?
It was final in 2008 when the conviction was affirmed and the sentence was ordered in execution. I think this case comes right down to the mandate rule itself. The exception that was used by the trial court here was simply that the sentence had not yet been executed because he wasn't. But when we look at those cases and look at the law, there was a former statute that provided under the shock, super shock system that we had, which now became judicial release, allowed the trial court the specific authority to amend a sentence prior to delivery to the institution. And when I look at those cases, they cite to the federal court system. The federal court system recognizes a common law power of the trial court to amend its sentence during its term. Now, if we look at those cases, that's not analogous to Ohio. Ohio abrogated common law in the criminal code in the 1950s and 1952, I believe, when it was rewritten the first time. So in that regard, there is no statutory authority. This court recognized that in Cruzado versus Alesky. Valid final judgment can be altered by the trial court in two means. It's either to correct a void sentence, which is not this case, or to correct a clerical error. That sentence was final. It was subject to an appeal and review. It was affirmed. The trial court was ordered to execute that sentence, and it should have done so.
Counsel, is the rationale for this that when an appeal is filed, it not only raises all the issues that are expressly raised, but impliedly raises any issue that could be raised?
Yes, and that.
So the decision of the appellate court really goes to the whole judgment as opposed to only those issues that are put in issue expressly in the appeal?
No, it's all issues that could have been raised at the time of the appeal. We must have finality, or else we end up with a situation like this. A sentence in 2007, here it is almost 2012, and that sentence is yet to be executed.
But the propriety of a three-year sentence is not argued when it is remanded to the judge. The motion for this modification of the sentence is not predicated on the fact that this was a wrong sentence to begin with, or there was some error in the sentencing of the 3 years. It's based on kind of a hardship argument that they'd like a modification based on this hardship of the physical condition, the need for dialysis, et cetera.
No, and I agree that was the reason used.
But
there is a mechanism in the law, Your Honor, under the to appeal to the Department of Corrections for medical release to appeal to the governor for a commutation of the sentence. There's nothing that would preclude that.
But here's my concern based on Justice Cupp's question to you, is that yes, an appeal should take care of everything that is appealable or should have been appealed at the time the appeal was made. Here, there was no basis to challenge the sentence when the appeal was made to the 8th District on the first direct appeal. It wasn't an incorrect sentence. It wasn't contrary to law. It was up to the judge, and the minimum sentence of 3 years was imposed. And but for this man's physical condition, it would have been executed.
But for the fact that his physical condition was known at the time of the original sentencing, the argument for community control was made, and they could have raised that on the first appeal.
Well, it's not appealable. You can't say I'm entitled to community control because I'm sick. That's not an appealable issue to the 8th District.
That would be under an abuse of discretion standard, under whether or not the prison sentence should have been deviated from. Whether it should have been, and I believe that they could challenge that, and that defendants have challenged and made those challenges in the past under 2953.08. So I believe that the term or the type is always subject to direct appeal. Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, counsel, would we have to modify or overrule special prosecutors if we were to reverse this decision?
If this decision was reversed, I think it would eradicate the concept of law of the case under special prosecutors and the concept of res judicata under State versus Perry. This sentencing issue was ripe for review. It was raised after, in fact, 2 years after the sentence was affirmed.
And even though the sentence itself wasn't appealed, the Court of Appeals gave the mandate to execute the sentence because it affirmed the conviction.
Yes, and
the only thing the trial court had, the only jurisdiction it had was to follow the mandate of the Court of Appeals and execute the sentence. Is
yes,
that correct?
I believe that's the summary of my argument, that after an appeal, there is no authority to act except under the mandate or unless the court is given a specific statutory ability to amend that sentence or alter
brief,
that
counsel,
sentence.
Counsel, you raise that issue. You talk about 2929.51A was repealed in 2004. You indicate that prior to 2004, there was specific statutory authority that allowed a court to modify a sentence prior to execution, but your contention is since that statute was repealed, there is no subsequent statute granting that authority.
Exactly. Once a criminal judgment is final, it's final under criminal 32C and journalized, the only means that that sentence can be altered is by an appellate court or reviewing court, or by specific statutory authority, a judicial release, or it can be attacked in a post-conviction petition for relief on constitutional grounds.
Is it correct to say that this matter was considered by the 8th Appellate District in an en banc review?
No, this wasn't.
It was not.
It was not.
Was there a conflict with this case and Williams in the 8th District?
With the dissenting judge noted that Williams had recognized the ability of a trial court to amend a sentence prior to delivery to the institution or its execution, and believed that this case was in conflict.
All right.
However,
go ahead.
This Williams was not a post-appellate case. So I believe this case comes directly to the mandate rule.
Is this a common practice among either trial judges or others in Cuyahoga County to receive a decision from the appellate court and then modify a sentence before the time, after the decision comes back to the trial court. What is the practice of?
The practice is to follow the mandate. This is an exceptional case that the trial court actually did not follow the mandate and execute. I've been
so. Are most there. Of the individuals who have been sentenced to the institution on probation during the pendency of an appeal, or are those persons incarcerated?
They are either incarcerated or given a bond pending the appeal. In this case, Mr. Carlisle was not incarcerated because he was given a bond pending the appeal by the trial court.
And in those instances where the bond has been granted, are you finding that trial judges are modifying sentences, or is this a highly unusual circumstance?
As far as I know, this is the only one that came to my attention, and I've been in
been there
since 1999.
Thank you.
I'd ask that this court affirm the 8th District's opinion and ask that this court remand this to the trial court for execution of sentence. Thank you.
Ms. Cunliffe, you have a little less than a minute and a half.
Counsel, if you're put on probation and there is no execution because you're not delivered to a prison, and let's say you're on probation for 5 years, under your interpretation, if that issue of the sentence was not appealed, does the judge then have the ability during that 5-year period to modify that sentence? Because there's no execution.
I've never seen a situation where somebody is sentenced to probation and that's not an execution of a sentence.
So you don't think putting somebody on probation is, that doesn't equivocate to execution?
If Mr. Carlisle or anybody else is put on probation, his sentence goes into execution the minute he walks downstairs to the probation department.
Okay, so you don't, so being on bond is different than starting your probation
period. That's correct. The General Assembly provides explicitly for bond pending appeal.
Okay, then the second question is, if we follow your interpretation, what is to keep defense counsel or a defendant from appealing a sentence that he may or may have a basis to appeal or may not? I mean, in this case, you certainly had a basis. You could have appealed the denial of the probation. You don't appeal the sentence part. You appeal other issues. It comes back, and now you have an open door to go back to the judge. I mean, what's to keep attorneys from deliberately not appealing parts of a sentence so they can go back and challenge it again before a judge?
I apologize. I don't understand the question.
In this case, it was said, okay, you couldn't appeal the sentence, the 3-year sentence. Well, you could. You could appeal that they asked for community corrections, right?
No.
You didn't ask for community corrections at the trial?
I wasn't the lawyer. Okay. I don't believe the community corrections was requested. Certainly the trial lawyer looked for the minimal sentence, but...
That's what the prosecutor represented, that community corrections was asked for.
Well,
okay,
neither of us were there, so...
Assume that community corrections was asked for, was denied. You don't appeal it. You don't appeal the 3-year sentence. Court doesn't address it. You can come back. Now you say, under your version, you can challenge this, you can ask for modification of the sentence.
Well, I don't think that this issue was ripe at the time that the sentence was imposed, and I guess that's the distinction I'm trying to make here, and I apologize if I'm talking around your question.
My concern is if we say there's no finality, you can go back and challenge any part that wasn't appealed. What's to keep attorneys from not appealing certain parts if they think they have a better shot at the trial court?
Because res judicata requires you to raise issues that can be raised, and it bars you from resurrecting them once they've been decided against you, or if they could have been raised, you can't raise them later.
Could you have raised the issue of this defendant had serious medical issues and should not have been incarcerated? Could you have raised that issue?
No.
Why?
No, because they were not as serious as they became later. And again, he was out on bond, and what happened was his condition deteriorated. And I think contextualizing what happened here at the time of the modification, the economy had just gone into a terrible downturn. There was a lot of pressure. This judge felt a lot of pressure financially from the state. Our Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections director at the time went public saying, we can't afford to take care of these inmates. And the judge was that resonated with the judge. And so based on that concern and the cost, which at that point had accumulated substantially, and the deteriorating condition, which actually has deteriorated and continues to deteriorate, even though he's out,
Ms. Cundiff, can you address the state's position that 2929.51A was repealed in 2004 and therefore removed any ability for trial courts to modify sentences once they've been issued?
First of all, 2929.51, to the extent that it addresses the concerns here, modifications of felony sentences prior to execution, was actually repealed in 1996. When SB 2 came out,
How does that impact your argument? The legislature made an intentional decision to take that authority away. How does that impact your argument?
Because the General Assembly has to, we can't presume because they're silent on a particular issue that they mean to circumvent the court's authority.
Repealed it. It wasn't that they were silent. They took it away.
Well,
there was authority that existed, and then the legislature took it away. I don't call that being silent.
Well, if you look at the history of SB 2 and why it was enacted, it doesn't make sense that they were trying to curtail judicial authority. Actually, SB 2 was all about giving judicial authority, sentencing authority, back to the trial judges. And all this did was take, coalesce, remove that section, and then it coalesced shock probation and several other kinds of removal from institutions. It took that power away from the Department of Rehabilitation of Correction and put it all into the sentencing, the judicial release statute. But it didn't, at that point then, there was still the authority granted trial courts to modify the execution of sentences, either up or down. I mean, certainly there has never been explicit authority for trial courts to increase sentences prior to execution. And yet, all along, since for hundreds of years, courts have been able to do that prior to execution. And so to argue that because the legislature is now silent on that power, that means that the court has no authority, when the court has always had authority to increase the sentence, and has consistently, even before this authority was given, has increased and modified sentences prior to the execution.
But counsel, mostly when we're talking about the increase or the modification, we're talking about prior to execution, but we're not talking about the impact that an appellate decision has on what the court can do.
Again, that can be governed by the mandate rule, the law of the case, and race judicata.
Special prosecutors.
Right, but special prosecutors, again, and I know I've completely run out of time, but special prosecutors readdressing an issue that had already been addressed. And in this case, that is not what happened. With that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.